who remembers, there were really four things that happened on the year 50 besides the horn blowing. That was that's the announcement that was made on the 50th year. At the end of the 49th year, the ram's horn blows. Do you remember seeing Godspell? Did any of you see the movie or the play? The opening scene is the blowing of this ram's horn. And I think it's a very jubilee symbol. And then you have to understand the excitement of this year because you'd probably only hit one in your lifetime. Right? And if you're really lucky, you would hit two, right? Maybe at age 10 and age 60. Right? So there were really then four things that happened on the year of Jubilee. What was one?
What?
Yeah, okay, slaves, free.
All debts were canceled.
Yeah, debts canceled.
Land to the original owner.
Yeah, land to original owner. We have to be careful when we're talking man of spirituality, the Hebrew Bible, to ever use the word owner. Because a basic understanding of that spirituality is that we do not own the land. It is owned by God. But it is, yeah, that would actually be better to say the original steward of that land. There is also a sense that that was eternally given by God to a family in stewardship. And we'll get to that when David tries to take a piece of land away from Naboth's vineyard. Oh, it's Ahab. Thank you very much. Naboth just responds, how can I give the land that was entrusted to my family by God and to my ancestors? And then what was the fourth then? Yeah, the land rests. And two of these, three of them were also true of the Sabbath year. So this was really the unique mark of Jubilee year, was all the land restored to its original steward. And both the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee, you have to think of yourself as one who has come into hard times. Imagine the joy that would go through the prairies of America today if it was announced to all the farmers. If you've been reading about this lately, just a horn blew throughout Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, and Minnesota, and South Dakota. All debts are canceled. That would begin to give you a feel of Jubilee year. I want to review. Oh, Linda, were you going to say something?
But I've been reading the magazines too. There's going to be a lot of farmers without land or without instruments to work in that.
Yeah, I just read the news report this morning on the plight of the farmer, and the fear is that the fear is that the land of the United States is going to go gradually to large corporations that don't have a sense of care. David, you could probably say a lot more about that than I. Yeah.
Well, I don't
know.
It's
a crisis.
In our area, that most of the farms are owned by those that run it, or some connection.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any corporations in Chicago owns this such and such a land ran by such and such a farmer. I don't know of any of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's still a
What would be interesting to find out how much land is owned and run by the owner, as opposed to he may own some land, but then he rents some other land.
Yeah.
How much land is run in the state that is rented?
By another farmer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which in a sense is, in a way, sort of like an absentee landlord.
Yeah. The Newsweek article said one thing that was exactly the sense of how you would feel in Old Testament times. It said the pain of driving past the farm that was once yours, your parents, your grandparents, to actually drive by it and see it, and it's generations, and it's had to be sold because of the current crisis. Well, that really hit me. And when we get up to Jesus' time, we're going to see it was exactly the same type of situation. I want to review too some of the ideas of the spirituality. Remember, we'll go back to that word again, spirituality, or another way is to say, I like to say a spirited, or a certain spirited means breath, way of life. And so spirituality could be called a way of life that's breathed or spirited by God. And here are some of the things now that are emerging. And this is a review, I know, but it helps me. One is you own nothing. And then all, and I use this word twice, all is God's gift for all. In other words, you get it? This is all the blessings. This is all the people. And of course, that means to be shared by all. And then, so it's a life of trust that God is the one who provides. And that's one of the things that Brueggemann mentioned. I forgot exactly how he said it, but how do you entrust, pray for daily bread when you own the bakery? Didn't he say something like that? And then there's, in this, there's a sense of equality, that all are under God and not under a human king. And the leaders that are chosen now are given authority by the people to enforce the law of God and not to make laws for themselves and for their own advantage. That hit me last night when I was thinking through this, the difference in leadership under Moses and the leadership in Egypt. The people in the wilderness give to certain people the responsibility to help them make sure that they keep the law that is given by God. See how different than that is than picking a leader who's going to decide what the law is and become a rule to himself or herself. So it's a leadership of giving to a person the responsibility to really enforce what we've all agreed that we want to live. And it'll become the meaning of authority and discipline in the Christian church, or in the early Christian church. Did I miss anything? There's a sense of rest, that life is not work. Life is not accumulation, but it is receiving nourishment. I'm making this up as I go along. Receiving nourishment to do what life really is. Maybe be would be a better word. And that is to live in fellowship and unity and harmony with God and others and nature. And as Elmer added, anything else that doesn't fit in those three categories. Now, my the thesis of our eight sessions is that the Hebrew Bible sets this spirituality and gives it as a gift, and that Jesus comes to renew it. So that's kind of the thesis that we're following through. So, did you get it? Does anybody need me not? Okay. Now, we left last time at the border, here's the border, the people come in, here's the Dead Sea. Sea of Galilee, Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and they come here now to cross over into the land. And the picture now in Deuteronomy is all of them gathered and Moses delivering these sermons to them. And I want to read just one of the sermons of Moses, or part of it. And you might have, if you read the part of Deuteronomy, you might have read. But think of yourself now looking over the border into the land that is the promised land of God. And then Moses says this. This is probably later writing that is written back into the mouth of Moses, but also could have some original things from Moses. That's something we never quite know. Israel, remember this, the Lord and the Lord alone is our God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. And never forget these commands that I'm giving to you today. Teach them to your children. Repeat them when you are at home and when you are away, when you are resting and when you are working. Tie them on your arms and wear them on your foreheads as a reminder. Write them on the doorpost of your houses and on your gates. You've seen the little box on the door of a Jewish home? Faithful Jews still follow this. They have a little box on their door. Open it up and you pull out this teeny little scroll that has these words. And also very Orthodox Jews still wear them, as it says here, tie them on your arms. They have the covenant tied on their arms and also on their foreheads. Just as the Lord your God promised your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he would give you a land with large and prosperous cities which you did not build. The houses will be full of good things which you did not put in them. And there will be wells that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive orchards that you did not plant. And when the Lord brings you into this land and you have all you want to eat, make certain that you do not forget the Lord who rescued you from Egypt, where you were slaves. And it's over and over. Do not forget. Do not forget. Do not forget. Do not forget. And then what is the Jewish celebration that you'll never, never forget? Passover. And to this day, the solemn time for Jewish peoples, and I mean by that a joyful solemnity, not joyful solemnity of the time of remembrance, is Passover. And if you ever have chance to become friends with a Jewish family so you can get yourself invited to Passover, do it. Because one of the joys of the Passover meal is the sense throughout the Passover that we were in Egypt. I was in Egypt. And God brought me out of Egypt and brought us out of Egypt. You kind of bring the whole past into the present and you become part of that past, and that past becomes you. Now, I'd like to just briefly now look, we're kind of running over Bible history quickly, just mention how the land is divided, because it's very important in carrying on our manna spirituality, and that's the part I asked you not to bother reading. Right? Chapter after chapter in the book of Joshua, on how the land is divided. And when you read it all, you figure out there's one principle, and it's simply this. Who gets a bigger piece of land? Yeah, the large clan gets a big piece of land, smallest clan gets the smallest. And the land is divided exactly like manna. So we get a hint here that the land is now the manna. And you are to think of the land as you thought of manna when you were on the wilderness. And it doesn't say, but you can assume that a large clan had this and then would also do the same. The family units within the clan then would, the larger piece, smaller family unit, a smaller piece. So that's But the basic point here to remember is that the land is divided like manna. Then a marvelous chapter in the Bible is Joshua 24. And now, in the meantime, we go into a very difficult part of the Old Testament where they're conquering the land. And it's the sense of holy war and bloodshed and slaughter. I think, are we going to do the peacemaking? You know, we're going to get into that there, I think, the meaning of holy war in the Old Testament. Bill has that all figured out, so I certainly wouldn't want to usurp your... The reason we're laughing, it's very difficult to talk about. It's the kind of thing that you were hoping somebody else... Or it's a real... Have you struggled with that? How God seems in the Old Testament to ask these tribes now that are conquering the land to wipe out whole peoples. And so we'll look at that then. Let's just look at a part of Joshua 24. And after the land is conquered, and it's not completely conquered, there's still a lot of the people left. Now Moses, it's Joshua. Now Moses never gets into the land. It's Joshua who gathers all the people now for covenant renewal. Or this would be like a married couple now making a renewal of the marriage vows. And here Joshua says in verse 14, "So now fear Yahweh and serve him perfectly and sincerely. Put away the gods that your ancestors served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve Yahweh. But if you will not serve Yahweh, choose today whom you wish to serve, whether the gods that your ancestors served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are now living." Then Joshua says, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And then now as a response to the people, "We have no intention of deserting Yahweh and serving other gods. Wasn't it not Yahweh our God who brought us out and our ancestors out of the land of Egypt?" And then there's a confession again of what God has done. And then, "We too will serve Yahweh, for he is our God." That's verse 18. And then it says in 23, "They cast away the alien gods among..." Joshua says, "Then cast away the alien gods among you." You know, these people had little fertility gods and goddesses stuck away in their suitcases. Now this is a big time of marriage renewal when we get rid of them. "And give your hearts to Yahweh, the God of Israel." And the people answered Joshua, "It is Yahweh our God we choose to serve. It is his voice that we will obey." Now, I want to make a chart, it's really explaining the chart that's on page 4 of the little pamphlet in here. Because this is, most of the help for this chart came from Paul Hansen, who taught Hebrew Scriptures up here at Holden 2 summers ago. And I modified the chart a little, but it's basically his chart of how now, when they enter the land, the sense of how society is set up. And its first is what we've already mentioned, that Yahweh is the only sovereign. And Yahweh then gives manna, which now can be translated land, but I think we would translate it as blessings. Yahweh gives blessings. And then there's a sense, because Yahweh is the only king, there's a sense then among the people of an equality under Yahweh. But however they choose leaders who are responsible to be judges to assure that the law of Yahweh is kept. No, the people then dedicate themselves to two things. And these, and I think under here would be a sense of thankful, thankful receiving. And then they're really tied together by two things. One is righteousness, and the other is mercy. Now, you'll see these two concepts now all through the Hebrew Bible. Righteousness here meaning that we will keep the covenant word. We will keep the covenant word. But you'll notice that is not enough. There needs to be beyond the covenant word a certain spirit. And this is the spirit of mercy, which very specifically in the Hebrew scriptures mean that we will, I use the word here, we will care deeply about those who are the most vulnerable. What was that?
Pepper.
We will care deeply about those who are most vulnerable, those who are the most weak, and those who are at the greatest disadvantage and could easily slip into the position of being exploited. And this was the poor, those on whom misfortune has fallen, and the stranger. And then specifically, the poor almost exclusively became known as the widow and the orphan. These are the most vulnerable. So there is this balance of keeping the covenant word, but always in a spirit of mercy for those who are the weakest. And you'll know that when you get to the life of Jesus, when Jesus had a conflict between these two, he chose this as being the depth of the law, even if sometimes you had to break this in order to keep this. And Matthew shows Joseph, when Joseph finds out that Mary is pregnant, Matthew sets up in the story Joseph as the perfect Jew. Because Matthew shows Joseph as wanting to keep the law perfectly by doing what with Mary? He had to divorce her according to the covenant. But then how did Joseph want to divorce Mary? Privately or discreetly, or doesn't the King James say privily? To do it in the most sensitive, most tender way. And then the angel of the Lord comes, and Joseph discovers that to keep the law most deeply is to care so deeply about Mary that he will keep her, and in a way then he breaks the letter of the law. But it's an example of the tension between these two, and to be a Jew is to live in that tension of righteousness and mercy. And Paul Hansen, when he was here, the Old Testament professor from Harvard, could not emphasize this enough, that to be a Jew or to be an Israelite, now we don't start calling them Jews until after the Babylonian captivity. To be an Israelite was to live in this tension, and with this tension of righteousness and mercy. Another way to picture this society is just to think of the blessings of God as the manna, like this, and the land, and then just have all the people under together receiving. That's another way to picture it. Now, who asked, Carolyn, did you ask the question if they did this? Mm-hmm. Okay. During the period of the judges, now this would be the time like from like 1,200 to 1,000. I think I'm approximately right there. They lived a simple agricultural society where they had no king. And how this worked then is when there was a threat, a military threat, then they would start to be pressured by this military threat. And then what they would do is just kind of spontaneously, one among them would rise up and be the leader during the crisis. And then after the crisis, that leader would kind of just fade back into the equality. And these great, charismatic, kind of natural leaders that kind of came forth in the time of crisis. And we could just stop here and say, America is in a crisis. Let's pray for a leader. You know, that should be the prayer of every community of people, you know, that they... It's a related but a different subject. But a spontaneous leader would arise, and they were called the judges. And now, let's just try to remember the names of a few of them. Who was the most famous of the judges that rose up to deliver and lead the people through a time of crisis during this very... this is also sometimes called the primitive Israel, the primitive days of Israel. Okay, Samuel was the last of the judges. Solomon was a king. We're going to get to the kings.
Samson.
Deborah. It's wonderful that it was a spirited person, whether it was a man or a woman. Gideon was one of the... That's one of the neatest stories. Neat. I don't know if that's the best story.
He
was kind of the last of the judges and the first of the prophets. But he was called a judge of... Also was called a judge of Israel. And he had more of a continual leadership, that they looked to him for more continual leadership than just a temporary...
Jephthah.
Is he the one that killed his daughter?
How do you spell Jephthah?
J-P-J.
Okay, now Joshua was the leader of the conquest of the land. Now we're in what we'd call primitive Israel.
Yeah.
And the Gideon story is fun because it's just one of those favorite Sunday school stories. Just a few people with some pots, 200 of them break the pots, and the Midianites see all these lights all of a sudden go running, and they have a marvelous military conquest by simply breaking their pots. And thus, when you go into a hotel today, you see your Gideon Bible with a little pot in the front. Isn't that fun to make connections? Because they're named after Gideon, the judge who broke the pot. But the answer is, I think there was some real attempts during this time, with failures, of course, to live this kind of equality and under the sovereignty of God, keeping the covenant law. And
so they did actually declare the year of
Jubilee. I would, you know, scholars tend to go back and forth on that one, but I can't... I can't see it being in the covenant law without their at least trying it. Yeah. And it was tried off and on through the years with a lot of loopholes. And see, it's interesting how this righteousness and mercy, this side covers the loopholes. This side, you can always find some way to get out of it, right? If you don't have the spirit of this side, of righteousness and mercy. Okay. Now, in the midst of this, the military pressure or the threat from the outside becoming more intense. So you started having two factions within this. One is that this is the way it always must be. with Yahweh as our only sovereign, and when there's a crisis, God will take care of us. God will raise up a charismatic leader to see us through that crisis, and we'll return to this community of equality. There was another group of people, now a growing number of people, whom we would call the realists. Realists, who were saying, this just isn't working. We need a king. So you have this faction, and you have to think of this as our most divisive national crises we might have today. Today it might be the pro-abortion and the pro-choice and the anti-abortion or pro-life, all those names you get. But there's such a division and a conflict in our nation, and now in this primitive Israel, this was the big argument. When you gathered at the well, you would argue, do we need a king or do we not? And the realist says, we're never going to be able to get through in our world in which we live unless we have a king. And then the more traditionalist said, no, this is the covenant that God gave us to live, and God is our only king. And now what I'd like to do the next minute is, one of the interesting things in the Old Testament or Hebrew Scripture, you have both the pro-king and the anti-king arguments that find their way into the Hebrew Bible. And I'm going to divide you into two groups. We did this the last semester. So it's not, you have to be in two different groups since you've had practice, you and Linda.
Well, everybody else is
me. Okay. Divide in, and one of you will be the pro-king people and the other the anti-king, and I'm going to give you each a passage, and I want you to pick maybe one person or maybe you all, and we'll just have a fun little debate. And one side, you come and tell us why you think it's okay to have a king and why we can still preserve the way Yahweh wants us to be with the king. And the other side, you come and say why it's just not going to work. Okay. How should we? Should we go pro, anti? Let's go pro king, anti king. Do you want to start, Linda? And then you two switch because so they won't be together. Okay, we'll go pro, anti, pro. Pro-anti, pro-anti, pro-anti. Do you want to play? Okay. Pro, Eleanor, anti, Dave, pro, Karen, anti. Okay, now if you're pro, here's your text. Deuteronomy 17:14-20. Now I have to explain this, that the pro-king argument is read all the way back into a sermon of Moses. So Moses is actually saying, sometime you're going to have a king and that's going to be okay. You see how it works? And in other words, it's put back into a former, but it actually is the pro-king argument. And then the anti-king argument is 1 Samuel. And Samuel, the last prophet, or the last judge and the first prophet of Israel, was the leader of the anti-king forces. 1 Samuel 8:1-22. What I'd suggest, just to get together in the group, read it out loud, and then write down your arguments.
October 9th.
Right. Well, we're in a little village here. I decided to just call you together because I realized there's a little tension among you. Some of you are saying we need a king, and others are saying that we certainly cannot have a king, and I thought we would just get together and discuss it today. And maybe we could start with the pro-king people just telling us why then maybe you could say what your feelings are. We just want to get all the feelings out on the table here. You want to start? Which one of you wants to do that?
It's just not working the way it is. All the other nations have a king, and we need to be like them, fight our battles for us, and to be our leader. And we can't have an army unless we have a king. Because we can only acquire an army if we have a king. And we don't, see, this king would be God appointed. That's some foreign person, but someone that has experienced our life and knows what to be an Israelite is like, and would be a real common person. Wouldn't be greedy. Because then that would be too much going back to the Egyptian ways. See, this person won't be greedy and multiply the silver and gold. And there's another thing, the most important. This person will always be reading over the law. Always right at the table there. So, as never to favor one way, right or the left, or what did we say? But he's gotten that imprinted in his mind at all times. And so as never to become arrogant or feel that they're better than the rest of us. It's really legitimate that we have a king.
Another important thing is that he or she is one of us. It really is an Israelite, not a foreigner. He has our best interests at heart.
And we'll honor God just as we do.
Yes.
Are there any counted? Is there any?
We should say one more thing. Oh. We have to be realistic about this. We know that Samuel and his son, Samuel's not going to live forever, and his sons just aren't doing the job. We have to have better leadership.
And remember that Moses is the one who asked us to do this, and he promised. He promised that God would choose our king, and our only response is whether to obey God's choice or not.
Where does it say that?
Right in the book.
So you need a king to fight your battles. Who's going to fight your battles? Ghosts?
Well. Anybody want to respond to that?
Just that the king would be one of us, and would be under Yahweh and following the covenant.
You say that the king is one of us, and yet it says here at the on verse 18. When that day comes, when the day comes that you finally realize that you are the slaves of the king, you're going to cry to the Lord and say, "Help us in this situation." The Lord is not going to hear us. If we find that the king is not doing what we want, is not following Yahweh, then the Lord will not hear us.
Being king takes a lot of time managing things. How is a king that has to manage all these things going to have time to read the scriptures and to study the law?
Did a king bring us out of the land of Egypt?
I think you're being a little too legalistic about things here. We have to look at how God works now right now, we'd be a unique kingdom with a king. We're not like those other kingdoms. We have Yahweh as our leader. So that right there colors the whole approach to our how we fight our battles and how we collect for monies for the armies. I mean, it's the spirit of Yahweh. It's not like, it wouldn't be like the other kingdoms.
When we showed ourselves so willing to follow the spirit of Yahweh, as soon as Moses went off up into the mountain for 40 days, what happened? He came back down to find us worshiping the gods that the other nations were. How come now we're suddenly going to be so righteous and pure that we're going to keep Yahweh as our king and our God, even if we have an earthly appointed king? I haven't noticed that we've been able to handle that in the past.
Well, you learn from our mistakes.
Well,
learn from history.
Should I give a cut on this? It's interesting, you both are very religious and you both quoted the Bible. I think you got a feel though for the argument, and it's very much each side would be claiming to be realistic. Probably the final argument of this side was you can be as righteous as you want, but what good does that do if you're wiped out? That probably would be the final argument. And this side won in the actual history of Israel. They prevailed with their argument of what they called realism, and then this would be the very much the minority side. You get a sense in the, this is a Samuel and a few of the old traditionalists, and their final word is wait and see. Wait and see. And then and you also have the scriptures, and God enters into this, and God is always going back and forth with these mind changes, you know. And God finally says, okay, you want a king, give you a king if you want it. And I remember Paul Hansen saying this is an example of this faith statement of God kind of changing God's mind, is that God kind of works with situations as they are. You know, this is kind of the way it is now, and God kind of says, if this is a way the people decide it has to be, I'll give in. And then I will work with this new situation as best as I can. So that's where we are now. So now we're going to try a king, and they're saying you're going to become like all the other nations. This side is saying, no, we aren't, because Yahweh and the covenant still stand over the king. And they use this argument very well. This king will be one of us who understands the covenant too. And that was a good argument to come back and say, just remember how good have we been in the past. Now, these are the optimists. You know, on this side would accuse your side of being very pessimistic. You know, and you would just say you're being realistic. They would say they're being realistic.
It's always tomorrow and do better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to do better. So now let's look. We just have a few minutes. Let's look at the kind of kings now that, and the faith spirit of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures is now that God picks the king. And the first choice is Saul. And God goofs. You know, if you read the Saul story, Saul just turns into a miserable paranoid, suspicious, and so God says, I've got to get rid of this king, I made a mistake. So now I'll go find another king. And then goes to the sons of Jesse in Bethlehem to pick one of the sons. And it's really now the prophet. Now, a Bible trivia person has to help me. Who's the prophet now that helps
Nathan?
Nathan. Am I right? That helps peck David?
Still Samuel.
Samuel's still around. This is a humorous story. You know, Jesse kind of lines up all his very sons that he believes have the ability to be king, and Samuel just looks at all of them. And these are the sons that are out fighting the battles. And finally Samuel just says, well, don't you have any others? You know, and then Jesse says, oh yes, there's David. And David's main job is to keep the sheep and bring sack lunches to his brothers who are fighting battles. He's a sack lunch carrier and the shepherd. And then God chooses David, and then we have what's a beautiful love story between God and a human being. God just really falls in love with David. You know, and here's one for the pro-king people. You know, it's working. Now, David has a sense of, as we had on, a sense of righteousness, of living under the law. David has a sense of mercy for the weak. And the people are saying, we were right. The covenant is being sustained under a king. And also David consolidates a kingdom. He defeats the enemies and gives to the nation of Israel national unity, protected borders, really a good life, and he expands the borders of the kingdom to the widest they ever were, I think, and ever will be. And it's a dream of the extreme nationalists or Zionists in Israel today that the borders of modern Israel will be the borders of King David. And God loved David so much that for centuries later, God shows mercy on the people for the sake of David. You know, centuries after David is gone, I will show mercy on you because I'm still remember David. And this was David perfect? We all know the Bathsheba story and other stories, but David repented and cried for mercy. And then David's son Solomon then becomes the king after David. And now what the anti-king people are saying, it begins to happen. Solomon is a big builder and now starts conscripting Israelites into workforces to do all of his building. Now we have a draft and a growing draft of military conscription. We have raising taxes to support all the kingly stuff. And then Solomon gets involved in what all kings of that time were known for, large companies of concubines. Is that the right word? Women in his court, harems, you know, and the anti-king people now would start to say, aha, we told you so, it's happening. And then at the end of Solomon's reign, Solomon represents the southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin. And the ten northern tribes are just seething with anger because of the way Solomon is taxing them and oppressing them. So when Solomon dies, there's a civil war, and the 10 northern tribes break away from the family of David. So then we have the great split of the kingdom into north and south. South being Judah, north being called Israel. Now, Tess, the capital of the south was Jerusalem, and the capital of the north, Samaria. And if you go to Samaria today, it's a wonderful archaeological dig. You can walk on the actual pavement that the kings of Israel walked on. They've dug down to that level of the walk where they walked.
Wow.
Now, next time, next time is our fifth session, right? So I want to get through with the Hebrew Bible part like halfway through next time, and then get into John the Baptist and the beginning of Jesus next time too.
Next time?
Mm-hmm. So let's just review what you can work on. Read during the period of the kings now, after the split of the kingdom, we have the rise of the great and famous prophets or preachers. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Micah, Hosea, Amos.
Well, Samuel, you said, was the first then.
Yeah. But it's really the great prophets now that arise at the time after the split of the kingdom. The earliest ones now being Elijah and Elisha. But it's the later prophets during this time that we know the best, and their writings are preserved. So if you would read the passages under page 5 and page 6, that would be this section. And they're just brief passages to read for next time. And always, this is kind of minimum. Now just find a place and just keep reading if you are so inclined. Under page 5 and page 6. Then in, just to keep the story going in the Bible Atlas, read up through read up to the Roman conquest. That would be up to page 59 in here. And this really keeps the story going for you in a way that we just don't have time to do in our class sections. Then next week sometime I want to discuss, this is a sermon that Dorothy Salle, are you familiar with Dorothy Salle?
No.
She's a German pastor, woman, of course she's a woman. German pastor, you'd never say man theologian, you know, that's always. So, but she's a German pastor theologian that has a lot of influence on world Christianity, and was one of the most, I think, powerful speakers at the World Council of Churches Assembly in Vancouver. This was her, one of her major speeches she gave at that assembly, and it's called Life in Its Fullness. And it really talks about hunger and poverty, and it's the one issue we want to get at next time, is that under the divided kingdom, you're going to have the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And under the kings, a class of the oppressors and the class of the oppressed. She will show how both are poor and both are hungry. And in other words, she's saying the whole world is hungry, and she applies it to today, but I want to show how next time it begins back in this period of the kings. So I have two library reserve copies, so can I give those to you? And then I have two what I call Lodge 6 float copies, which means they can just float around Lodge 6. Is there someone that would like one of these to start and then just pass?
I'm going to start one again.
Okay, and then just
yeah.
And what, you aren't in Lodge 6.
Yeah, I'm still in Lodge 6.
Oh,